Hello, and welcome to The Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and in studio with me today is Dan Drost. He's USU's Extension Vegetable Specialist, and we're here for you to take your calls and your questions or comments. Our toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495, or send us an email question at zestygarden@gmail.com. Dan, thanks for coming in.
It's good to be back again. It's the first Thursday of the month, and I think some of our readers have been asking, or some of our listeners have been asking about that. You know, when is Dan going to be on? When is Dan going to be on? We need to ensure that we hear what he has to say, and so here I am. It's the first Thursday of the month.
So that means everybody needs to call in, because this is actually, I get more questions about the gardening segment with Dan Drost than just about anything else.
Yeah, and I don't know why that is.
Because you know everything.
It's my bubbly personality, I think.
They just want to hear you say pumpkin.
Yeah, that too.
So we'd love to have you join our conversation. And the first thing that I want to start out with is, you know, it's going to be different throughout the rest of the state versus Cache Valley. But when to know when to plant. Now, we've already talked about to making sure that your peas, your lettuce, your spinach, all of that stuff should be in by now. What's next? Carrots should be going in?
Yeah, right now, I think, you know, it's been a little cold, but, you know, don't be fooled by that. That's part of the seasonal oscillations that we see in temperature. And certainly if you listen to Utah Public Radio all the time and you listen to the climate reports that are given by the Utah Climate Center, they obviously talk about that regularly. I listen to them every morning. I use that resource as an idea as to what to expect in the future. And, you know, we expect the weather to change, and therefore, the simplest way for you to go about figuring out whether you want to and should be starting to plant something is to actually track what's going on soil temperature-wise. And a simple way to do that is to buy yourself one of these cheap digital thermometers, and that thermometer is going to be used in your garden to tell you something about what's happening. Most of those are relatively inexpensive. You can buy them in most stores that sell houseware equipment and that type of stuff, pots and pans. You'll find them in that section. They run on a small battery, and you know, all you need to do is put it in the soil and push the button, and you know.
So just a probe
type
that you would use for your meat?
Absolutely.
Okay.
You know, you should have one for your garden, because what that's going to do is it's actually going to tell you a lot about it, of what's going on in your soils. Now, the next question is where should you take the measurement? And then the next question after that is, when during the day should you take that measurement? Because those are important timing factors as well. And so what we recommend is that you kind of think about where that seed is going to be located in the soil. So that's seeding depth. And it varies a little bit, but generally we say if you know what your soil temperature is at between a half inch and 1 inch deep in the soil, that's approximately the zone in which you're going to be seeding anyway. Some of our smaller seeded vegetables like carrot or lettuce, because they're so small, we tend to seed them a little bit shallower, but it's hard for us to get a temperature measurement up that close to the surface with, you know, kind of a large probe like a meat thermometer. But if you take it between a half an inch or thereabouts and 1 inch, that's going to be a rough estimate of what your soil temperature is like. And you would expect your temperature a little higher up in the profile to be warmer because the sun's going to be hitting it more. And then take that measurement at 1.5 or 1/2 inch to 1 inch depth. And then also think about what time of the day. Normally, we kind of want to know what the warmest temperature is, and we maybe want to know sometime what the coolest temperature is. And so we generally would say take your temperatures right around between, let's say, around 2 o'clock in the afternoon, because by then the soil has warmed up as much in the day as it's going to. And then you take your soil temperature, if you take it again early in the morning, you know, like at 8 o'clock, that tends to be about the time when it's at its coolest, because it's cooled down all night long. And yeah, you know, ideally we would say measure it. We usually see the coolest temperatures around between 6 and 7, but who's up at 6 and 7? I'm usually sitting in my chair listening to the early news at 6 and 7. You could go out and do it at that time, but that gives you kind of the fluctuation that's occurring in the seed zone. And as long as our soil temperatures for our cool season vegetables are above 40 degrees, that's suitable for planting those crops. So our cool weather crops like peas, spinach, lettuce, onion, carrot, parsnip, parsley, you name it, all of those cool weather crops that we are all familiar with, they can be planted in most places in the state right now, because our soil temperatures at the coolest are going to be, you know, falling down below that 40 degree mark. But during the day, on most days, they're going to be well above that. And so those seeds will start to take up moisture. They will start to reorganize membranes, and the embryo will start to develop, and the plant will start to grow. And within a matter of weeks, we will see little seedlings coming up. And so that's kind of how we would go about assessing it. So looking at the soil temperature at a half inch to an inch deep, taking a measurement at around 2 o'clock in the afternoon to give us some idea of what the warmth is occurring. And that then is kind of a good measure. If we're up well above 40 degrees, start planting. Now with our warm vegetables, normally what we would say is look at the last frost date, and often we can start seeding those at least a week before that. And so we can actually track those temperatures. And for our warm weather crops, we really want to kind of wait until the soil is 55 to 60 degrees, but preferably even higher, warmer than that. And we know soils warm up pretty fast. It's just how much they cool down at night, because we don't want it to be too terribly cold at night, unless we do some things to mitigate that temperature.
So then you just average?
Yeah, you can average it. That's a good way to go and do that. Or you can just say, yeah, okay, I went out at 2 o'clock and I measured it, and I did it over a 3 or 4 day time window, and the soil average soil temperature at 2 o'clock in the afternoon was 50. That would tell me to plant. And so in my garden, in my window boxes, or in my grow boxes that are up against the house, that, you know, things have been in for several weeks simply because we've been well above those kinds of temperatures. And you're going to run into a spell of weather like we've had the last few days, where we've had some moisture and it's been a little bit cold and there's been a little bit snow. But the soil temperature is falling, but it's not to the point where it's detrimental to those seeds that are there. And so as soon as it starts to warm up again, they're talking about that over the weekend. Next week, high pressure sets in. The soil day temperatures are going to be up in the 60s. Well, our soils are going to be much warmer than that because they're dark colored. They absorb solar radiation, that short wave that comes from the sun, and that heats up that surface, and that's the zone that seed is in. And so they're going to be progressing along at a nice pace. And it may take, you know, 10 days to 2 weeks for some of these plants to come up, and other ones will come up relatively quickly.
Can you talk about average date of last frost in a couple of areas of the state? So for here, Cache Valley, it's usually May 20th?
Yeah, it's about that. But, you know, it can vary tremendously across the valley, you know, if we look at our own valley. And therefore, what one needs to do is the Utah Climate Center, that gives us our weather information. If you go to their website, climate.usu.edu, I think their web page is, they have a tab on that front page that takes you to frost-free days. And so when you go to that, you can actually look for your own particular city. And that's more valuable to you than for me to say what the average frost date is for Logan. I constantly tell people that I know where I live. I live up by the Logan Temple, and I know what my climate's like because I tend to pay attention to the temperature gauges that I have outside my window and my little radio-controlled temperature thing, and I kind of know when things happen in my particular environment. But if I go down to the island, which is, you know, 150, 200 feet below me, that is very different. And if I come up onto campus, it's very different.
And if, you
and
go
if
to
I
Trenton,
go to Hyde Park, it's very different. And if I go to Wellsville, it's very different. So, but I don't live in Wellsville. I live in Logan. And so each person needs to kind of go and figure out for their own particular area. And the Climate Center has compiled most of that information already. And so if you can't get it for your particular town, you can get it for a municipality or a place that's relatively close to where you live. And then you should also kind of think about, you know, trying to use that information to help you better understand it. Because Utah is a beautiful place that's blessed with a million different environments simply because of the type of terrain that we have, our orientation south or north, the elevation, whatever features landscape-wise are in proximity to us. And so trying to learn your own environment is really, really important. And so you would plant in Hyde Park where you live at a kind of a different date than I would do something in Logan, simply because of where I sit in the landscape. And so the need for the public is to use the resource that's available. And if we go to Climate Center data, you can find that and they give you a rough average of it. And then, you know, you got to remember, not only is that average date kind of quantified over a relatively long period of time, but it also says, well, what are the extremes? You know, so you may say, well, our average date for Logan City is May 20, but that data was actually collected out at the airport. So if I'm up on Logan campus or near Logan campus, it might be May 10. And if I'm out in Wellsville, it might be, you know, June 1. And so, you know, you just need to kind of look at that kind of information. And there are tables that are on that page and they're, you know, viewable or downloadable. Once you put that information into your gardening calendar, so to speak, then you have it and you want to know kind of when you should be thinking about planting. And normally for warm weather crops, we would say you can probably plant about a week earlier than the frost date. If you're seeding crops, if you're transplanting crops with a little bit of protection, you might be able to seed a little bit earlier than that, or, you know, plant on this date and then understand that that number is a value that was averaged over a relatively long time frame, so many years. And within that many years, there's variability. And so those two outside extreme values is when was the earliest last frost and when was the latest last frost could be a month difference. So you got kind of a month window that you have to be a little bit concerned, particularly if we're sticking out a tomato plant or if we're, you know, trying to seed beans into the soil. We might want to, you know, be aware that these numbers aren't hard, fast numbers, that every year on May 20, it's not going to freeze anymore after that date. That's not what that number means. And so people can use that, and you just need to go to the Climate Center to get that. Or I think in one of our, some of our publications in our Common Gardening Questions Guidebook, we have a table that gives a few of those numbers, just a short summary for some of the major municipalities around the state. And but it also has a link in there that says go to the Climate Center to get this, because they have weather stations that are scattered all across and they can then use those, that information to calculate roughly what it might be if you were outside of town in some rural community that maybe doesn't have a weather station.
Well, I know you, as you garden, you certainly gain a greater appreciation for what a farmer has to go through. And you're not necessarily depending on it for your livelihood either.
Well, you know, I think there's a lot more people in this state that do garden for financial reasons as well. You know, they know that there's probably a couple of reasons. One might be financial. If you do the numbers, a few years ago, a couple students kind of calculated what it was. And if you garden and have a 20 by 20 garden, you basically can save like $500 over the summer on food costs And you tend to consume a higher proportion of fresh fruits and vegetables out of that as a result of just having the garden in place. And that can be a significant savings to a family in the summer. Plus, you often have excess, so that means you could put up product if you are so inclined to do it, store it in some way, either can it or freeze it or do something like that. Not as many people do that anymore, but certainly then you have product that's can be used into the fall and into the winter. I mean, I'm still eating beans from last year and corn from last year, and I have the last of chunks of melon because we had way too much melon, and so I just dice them up and froze them. And so, you know, we can use that in smoothies or whatever way you want it, or have it with a kind of a salad type thing. So there's lots of, you know, I think we're to the last of the asparagus. Thank goodness it's just starting to come up, you know, so I'm looking for fresh asparagus again.
Because so you really, see it come up?
I saw some, but, you know, we went and worked the soil and, you know, made sure that we were ready for some things we have. And so, you know, now with this cooler weather, it's falling back a little bit, but, you know, it won't be long and we'll have it. We're a little early this spring relative to some other things. So the last of the asparagus is coming out of the freezer, and I'm looking forward to the fresh because the frozen is not quite the same. But, you know, certainly it can be used in many ways to, you know, we throw it in a quiche or you put it in a stir fry or something like that, and you get the flavors that you want. And so there's benefits to that. And then that means I don't have to buy asparagus during the winter.
How I know that as far as prices for things like asparagus, I don't remember if it was you that I was talking with a month ago about how the California farmers are just tilling their asparagus in because they're being flooded. This market is being flooded by asparagus coming from outside the country.
Yeah, and so, you know, the prices have fallen back a little bit. And so, you know, the growers know what their kind of base price is that they need to cover all of their costs. And as long as they're above that, you know, if they're getting, let's say, a dollar a pound wholesale, and it's selling in the grocery store for, let's say, $1.89 or something like that, then, you know, the farmer says, well, I need to make at least 78 cents or something like that in order for me to make some money on the thing. Otherwise, they're going to just till it under. There's no point in them harvesting at a loss. That's really the thing. And they know that Easter's coming up, and so they kind of know that that means a lot of people buy asparagus in and around Easter, and they make big promotions around the country on it, and it tends to be one of those things that is kind of tied to Easter meals. And so, you know, they're looking, yeah, we want to certainly hit that market. And Easter tends to be a little bit later this year. And so there should be, you know, good quantities. And I suspect that the prices will be reasonable. And I noticed that, you know, California is getting some rain out of these same storms. So, you know, for the asparagus crop anyway, that's beneficial. Whether that helps other vegetable crops over the course of the summer is, you know, still to be seen. But growers there are, you know, weather watchers, and growers everywhere are concerned about those types of things as well.
Well, this is a program for our listeners. We hope you'll call in and with your own questions or comments. The toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. Or go online to upr.org, and you can send us a question that way. Or go to zestygarden@gmail.com and send us your email that way. I want to go back to warming up the soil. So if you put down black plastic, and I know it'll depend on, you know, how warm is it really outside and certain things, but approximately how long should you leave black plastic on if you're trying to raise the temperature to plant, say, melons or squash?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, normally what we would suggest that you do is that if you're going to be using plastics to try and warm up soils and to help support the growth of some of our warmer weather vegetables like melons or tomatoes or peppers, that we normally lay them at least 7 days before we're going to start planting in between them, into them. Simply what that will allow is the sun to warm up the plastic, and then that heat can get transferred down through the plastic to the soil. And so the plastic and the soil need to be in good contact with each other for that heat transfer to occur. And so it's kind of like the putting your hand on the hood of an automobile, a black automobile. It's warm, and that heat then will pass through, and we can use that to warm up the soil. Clear plastic does exactly the same thing, but it acts more like a greenhouse. So it's more like your car window. The sun passes through the shortwave radiation, and it heats what's inside the car, or it heats the soil that's underneath it. And that's why we often put plastics down there to try and generate more heat in the soil. And clear will absolutely generate more heat into the soil in a shorter period of time than black will. And so the student farm recently, you know, they planted their peas about the first week of March. What they did is they just laid a sheet of clear plastic over the soil after they planted them and allowed the sun to heat the soil underneath that. And it took about 8 days or 9 days, and those seeds were coming up. And then they kind of tented up the plastic. They left the clear in place, but they put some supports underneath it to lift it off the soil a little bit more so that it acted like a low tunnel. And now they've got pea seedlings out at the farm that are, you know, 3 or 4 inches tall already. And that
still underneath the plastic,
because it's pretty cold out there, and they kind of watch what the weather is like. So, you know, early next week when they're talking temperatures in the mid 60s, what they may do with that is they'll probably open up the ends of that tunnel, or they'll pull up the sides a little bit in an attempt to kind of keep the temperature slightly cooler for those pea plants, and they're just loving it. They're saying this is great. So that's another way that you can do it. And we took our thermometer early on and measured the temperature. Well, you know, okay, if the soil is a little on the cool side, plant your seeds anyway, and then just lay a strip of clear plastic over top of them, peg it down on the edges so it doesn't blow away in the wind, and use the sun to heat the soil up even more than it would if it was uncovered. And then just kind of pay attention to what's going on. And the rule that we tend to use is that the temperature underneath clear plastic is about 30 degrees warmer than what the outside temperature is going to be. And so if your day temperatures are going to be around 60, we may not want the temperature underneath that plastic to be 90 degrees. We would probably remove it on a day where it's 60, but on a day to like today where it's only in the 40s going to be, you know, that would be perfect, because now we're at 70, and that's the ideal temperature for all these cool weather vegetables to either germinate or to grow vigorously. And so you have to manage these things a little bit, and you have to think about things a little bit, but at least what that does is it gets some of those vegetables started for you more quickly so that you can start harvesting them more quickly rather than waiting till June or July to be doing some of these things. We can actually have product in May, maybe even late April, depending on when we started.
If you plant in black plastic, you just keep it there. I'm just thinking of my cantaloupes that I wanted. I just got to have some new cantaloupes as soon as I can get them.
Yeah.
You shouldn't plant in black, in clear plastic versus the black.
One gets warmer. You could plant through clear plastic,
but then you get the weed.
But you may get weed growth underneath there, and so that might be one of the deterrents for doing that. But you could also put the clear down, get the plants started, get them growing vigorously. The outside temperature at that time then is more favorable for their growth anyway. And then if you took grass clippings or straw or something like that, mulch underneath the plant, then that covers up the clear plastic. Mm. Then that also tends to keep the weeds from growing, because many of our weed seeds need light to germinate. And then once they've germinated, they need light in order to continue to grow. So if you're covering that plastic with grass clippings or with straw or something like that, then, or mulches of any sort, then that excludes light, so then the seedlings don't grow as vigorously or may die as a result of that. And the idea with black plastic is, well, that excludes the light initially, and so that tends to give us that same benefit without having to put additional mulch on. Now, some gardeners are always concerned, oh, it's going to get too hot there. Yes and no. Yes, it may initially be fairly warm underneath there, But once the plant starts to grow and the leaves start to shade the plastic, actually soil temperature underneath the plant isn't really any warmer than it would be if you didn't have the plastic in place. So you're gaining the benefit at the front end when you want it warmer, but the plant itself is growing so vigorously and it begins to start shading the ground underneath it, and so therefore it shades the plastic as well, and we don't see that extra heat that many believe is going to occur. And so they say, oh, I got to put plastic out, then I got to remove the plastic.
So you don't have to worry about any scorching going on.
No, not unless you're trying to use plastics in the middle of the summer and then saying to yourself, well, I'm going to plant some late crops for fall and I'm going to plant them through plastic in July when the outside temperature is in the mid-90s, then you're going to run into some problems.
But for my cucumbers or my cantaloupes, they're going to be creating the shade that keeps it from getting too warm.
Exactly. That's what we're going to expect them to do. And early on, the days might be warm, but the nights are cool. And what you're really trying to do is during the day, capture energy that you transmit into the soil, warming the soil up so that at night, the physics of soil heat loss is short wave in and long wave radiation coming out, and that long wave then moves back up and it warms the plastic, but the heat gets trapped underneath it, so it keeps the soil temperature warmer at night so the plants aren't under as much stress. Plus, some of it does escape around the plant to keep the air around the plant slightly warmer. And then that's why early in the season, if we're using plastics, we say plant 2 weeks earlier than your frost date. So once again, we come back to thinking about that day. And then maybe you need to put some protection over the top of them. So you use a floating row cover, some Remay or some other type of frost blanket, or you may build a low tunnel, or you may do some other type of a wall of water or a milk jug with a bottom cutout set around the plant to try and keep heat around the plant both during the day and at night. And that's what gives you your extra growth.
You're listening to The Zesty Garden, and Dan Drost is USU's Extension Vegetable Specialist. We're going to take a quick break and then be back for the rest of the program talking about gardening and vegetables. If you'd like to call in with a question or comment, it's 800-826-1495 or send us an email, zestygarden@gmail.com. Welcome back to the second half of our program. In our gardening calendar, Thanksgiving Point in Lehigh is holding a class on square foot gardening this Saturday from 10 to noon. In this workshop, you will construct a grow box from start to finish and also learn the details of vertical gardening for tomatoes, squash, and melons. Also learn how to protect your early and late season vegetables. Information is at thanksgivingpoint.org. And USU Extension is hosting a container gardening workshop Wednesday, April 9th from 6 to 8 at the Cache County Administration Building. Soil, plants, and seeds will be supplied. Bring a favorite pot or container. To register, call 752-6263. And the Tahnaquit Nature Center in St. George is featuring a free workshop on water-efficient landscaping Saturday, April 12th from 10 to 11 a.m. Understand how your system works and how to make it more efficient. The Tahnaquit Nature Center is at 1851 South Dixie Drive. Well, in the 10 or so minutes that we've got left on the program, first off, I wanted to talk about the resource and what's available. So you've got here in studio a guide to common gardening questions. It's a spiral bound. It's not quite book, but it's not a booklet either. So
no, it's about 110 page booklet, we would call it. It's got waxy coating to the pages so that it can go out in the garden. The water will run off of it. I mean, if you throw it in your water bucket, it's going to get wet, but you know, it will withstand the moisture that we would see out in the garden. And the focus of the guide to common gardening questions is kind of step-by-step recommendations for successful gardening. And we know that lots of people move to Utah. You know, they say, well, I had a lemon tree in Southern California. I want a lemon tree here in, Logan. Or, and we've had those questions, you know, how do I go about doing that? And my recommendation is you put it in a big pot and you move it into your living room for 8 months out of the year. And then the 4 months that the weather's nice, you move it outdoors. And so it basically becomes an indoor plant. And so, you know, this is kind of to help people like that. And the types of subjects that we cover are garden preparation. There's a chapter on that. Garden soil. Garden maintenance, and then nutrition and nutritional benefits from gardening and health-related stuff. And it's a total length of a little over 100 pages, and it tells you all about how to pick a place for your garden if you don't know how to do that, what varieties you might think about starting with, how to lay out a garden, how to plant, how to extend the growing season. So we talked about plastics and building low tunnels and high tunnels, so it gives you that. But also embedded within it is here are titles of all of the information that's available from the Extension Service at Utah State University. So the one place you can go to look at this is to go to garden.usu.edu, or if you just go to the Utah State University website, usu.edu, and then look on the front page for Extension, and then under Extension, you look for publications. Not only are you going to find publications about gardening, but you're going to find publications about food preservation. You're going to find questions about backyard chickens. You're going to find question about honey. You're going to find question and answers about small animals, horses, turf, trees, you name it. There's literally thousands and thousands of bits of information that are on that that will help you become a better gardener. And lots of people look at the vegetable ones. I think we have well over 70 publications that deal with vegetables. So if you're just a tomato person, you can find a publication just on tomatoes. Now, this month, we're going to come out with a second companion book to this one, and it's called A Guide to Common Organic Gardening Questions. And so this initial one, the first one we put out, the Common Gardening Questions, kind of covers some generic stuff. Doesn't talk a lot about herbicides. It talks a little bit about using fertilizers and those types of things. But the gardening one that deals with organics is geared specifically to those gardeners that want to have detailed information on how to garden organically and get more information on that. And that's a hot area. Lots of people like to make their vegetable garden as pesticide-free as possible, and that should, when that comes available. I think this Guide to Common Gardening Questions is either $12 or $14, and it has to be ordered through the university, and then it will be shipped to you, or you can go to your local cooperative extension office in your particular county, and you can buy it there. And the other ones we're going to do the same thing. I think we have some of them that will be spiral bound, but we're also working with one of the book publishers that sells a lot of books here in the States, a local publishing company, and I have a meeting with them next week about it, and they're going to actually take over the publication of it, the printing of this, and the distribution of it, because the university is finding it a bit difficult to do some of those things. And some of our larger publishers can do that at a much, much reduced cost. So that's probably the way that we're going to be marketing more and more of these types of things. Lots of information, however, is still on our Extension website that's downloadable PDFs, 2 or 3 pages of detailed information about how to grow just about any vegetable that you can think of that does reasonably well here in the state. You know, we're not probably covering all of them, but we're covering the ones that are of most interest to most vegetable gardeners in Utah.
Well, there's plenty to find out online, that's for sure.
Yeah, I mean, I cruise around in there periodically, and I'm amazed at what's in there. And so certainly that that's something that's really helpful. And it has, like I said, all the kinds of information that you want in an abbreviated form. And then there's hot links, or, you know, it will tell you the name of the publication that you have to go through to get the actual kind of, if you're going to say, I want to grow asparagus, you need the details on growing asparagus, because there's asparagus information in here, but it's minor relative to the fact sheets that we have.
Well, and those fact sheets are so helpful, because I've now got three beds of asparagus. Now, of course, I had the opportunity to talk to you directly as well, but I went back to those. I'm like, okay, what did Dan say? So looking at those particular publications really helped me get my beds established. And so now I'm really looking forward to reaping the harvest.
Yeah,
there's nothing like fresh asparagus.
And that's the kind of stuff that we do, you know. So there's things about, you know, soil testing, you know, is something that, you know, many people don't do often enough. And so they really don't know what the garden needs. Or if you're an organic gardener, people think that you don't need to soil test. Well, if you're regularly adding in animal-based composts, you know, manures that have been steer manure that's made into compost, poultry manure that's made into compost, what you need to understand is that over time, various nutrients tend to build up because they have lower or higher concentrations of particular elements. And sometime you need to know, oh, do I have too much phosphorus in? If you have too much phosphorus in and your primary compost is dairy manure, well, dairy manure tends to have lots of phosphorus in it, whereas poultry manure has very little phosphorus in it, and you may only be needing the nitrogen, but poultry manure has much higher nitrogen concentrations in it than does dairy compost. Mm. And so you may say, well, this is one of the things that people don't understand unless we provide them with that information. And so certainly by soil testing, we know, oh, I'm way above my phosphorus levels. I don't really need to be adding in, but I want to stay organic. So what other nutrient sources do I need? Most of our vegetables require lots of nitrogen. So I'm going to get that from a source of compost or other organic-based fertilizer. But I need to know what those are and which ones have high nitrogen and which ones have low phosphorus in them. And so that information is going to be available in this new guide. Plus, there are other publications online that provide that information as well. So it's not – people think that organic is easier. Actually, organic is harder, I think, because there's a lot of things to think about. And the things that happen slowly, but they do happen. And eventually, you know, they can come back to create an environment in your garden where it might be unhealthy because we've super loaded certain elements in it, and that creates some other problems for us later on in the year.
Well, that explains why the weeds do really well at the edges of my chicken manure pile when I muck out the chicken coop. So.
Absolutely. You know, there's a lot of nutrients that are in there, and, you know, so no system, and I don't mean to say that organic is really harder. Organic requires a little bit different thought process.
I was gonna say,
and yet the principles are the same. The plants need these various elements. They need water. They need sunlight. They need good soils. They need low salts in those soils. And all of the things that we do during the year are designed around trying to create an environment that's most favorable for them so that we can get the kind of productivity that we want and the quality of vegetables that are good for our families and good for us, and to have sufficient that I can either share or enjoy or put up or sell or whatever you're going to do with these things. And so you need to learn, and the resources that we have are there to help you, you know, become more familiar with what you need to know. And then the educators that are around the state, your county extension staff and individuals like myself and Dr. Black and Dr. Alston, you know, we're there to help our educators be competent in areas that they need more training in, and then also come on programs like this to discuss stuff that's kind of pertinent and timely. So seeding right now is timely. But in a couple weeks, we're going to start transplanting. So, you know, if we haven't started transplants, Are we too late? Well, maybe for some things like broccoli or cabbage, which we would start planting out the end of this month in early May, we might not get a big enough plant between now and then. But if you're still kind of waiting on growing your tomato transplants or your pepper plants, you might have some time depending on your frost date again and what kind of things you're doing to help improve the growth. And if you're going to grow melons here in Logan, let's say, yeah, we wouldn't seed our melon transplants until toward the end of this month so that they're available around the end of next month.
When would you plant them outside?
I would plant them around that frost-free day. That's okay. When I would do them. And
or if you put plastic in?
Maybe a little bit earlier, which means it takes about 4 weeks to grow a melon plant up to size to transplant, whereas it takes about 6 to 8 weeks to grow a tomato plant, and it might take 8 to 10 weeks to grow a pepper or eggplant up to size. And so, you know, you kind of have to look at those frost dates. That's why we talk about them. Find out the one for your particular area, and then you need to work back in the calendar and say, well, if it takes me 8 weeks to grow a tomato plant, then I got to start that relatively early, and that would mean, yeah, in the middle of March, maybe that's when you should be starting to plant that if your planting date is the middle of May for your particular area. Salt Lake Valley, that would be an appropriate time, or down in Provo or someplace like that. Their frost date is slightly earlier than here in Logan. Logan, we would normally say you're safe around the end of May, most places in the valley. And so you have to have about 8 weeks to grow that plant. So, you know, you should have started it by now. And your plants are probably going to be a little small if you start them today.
Well, this being a live program, I tend to switch things up every once in a while. I've decided that I'm going to delay until next week our next Petals and Pros segment because there's just too much to talk about as far as gardening. So if you were tuning in to listen to Nancy Williams.
Oh, dear.
I'll have Nancy on next week.
Nancy's going to call me up. She's not going to like the fact that I preempted her.
Well, it's a 17-minute segment, so it's like, I've got to talk more gardening. So, sorry, Nancy.
Yeah. But the vegetable guy only
she'll be
comes
okay
once,
with it,
yeah,
though.
Yeah, the vegetable guy comes only once a month anyway. So.
Yeah, Nancy will be okay with it. So we're going to have about another 9 minutes left in the program to talk about gardening. To get in your question or comment, 1-800-826-1495, or go online or send us an email question, zestygarden@gmail.com. So we're just talking about different things to plant and when it might be too late. Too late to put in peas? With St. George, I would say yes. But
yeah, if you're down in those warm regions, it's too late. If you're in some of the cooler upper elevation sites, you know, high mountain valley places and things like that, probably Panguitch is still plenty good. You know, so those of you guys that are down in Panguitch, you know, your soils aren't nearly as warm as they are up this way. And then the other thing to look for is, you know, what type of plant do you put out there? Now, the interesting thing about varieties are that we have different maturity classes. So you may have a 50-day variety or a 60-day variety or a 70-day variety. Generally, that indicates that it takes about that many days for under good conditions for that plant to come into production. So the pods on that pea plant are ready. We also have plants that are bush style plants or dwarf type plants. So like a bush bean versus a pole bean, the difference between those two is that the maturity class may be the same for a bush bean and a pole bean, but all that is telling you is that the plant is actually just starting to flower and fruit at that particular time, and those pole beans will continue to flower and fruit over a much, much longer window. And so if we think about that, you can go to your particular seed catalog or talk to your garden center manager or one of the helpers that is there that knows some of these types of things, or talk with one of the extension educators, or look in our publications and select stuff that matures on shorter, and we could then still plant peas now. And we just don't want to plant those late maturing types because that means they're going to flower when conditions are less favorable for their development as the season warms up and it gets, you know, brighter or hotter or something, drier, you know, all of those things that happen that could affect the growth of a plant.
But unless you're in St. George, your warm season stuff, you're not going to be putting it out.
Well, yeah. I've got a research trial going with one of the large melon growers down in St. George. And so next week I'm going down to St. George because we got a trial that we're putting out because he's starting his earliest planting of melons. And so they're already at melon planting time in St. George if you're in the garden. But he's down in Washington Fields. Anybody up in Vail, which if somebody said, well, where's Vail? It's St. George, you think, oh, yeah, it's the same climate. No. Vail is very high elevation on your way in the back way into St. George. And so you wouldn't plant melons in Vail at this time. You would still probably be 3 weeks from now. So that's why you need to learn where you live. If you don't know where you live when it comes to gardening, you're lost. That's the reality of it. Sure, I know my street address. I know how to get home. But from a gardening perspective, you are lost.
I had someone ask me just a couple days ago, I want to put in a pomegranate. And this is in Cache Valley.
Yeah.
I said,
yeah.
You know, like the lemon. I said, well, try growing it indoors and then putting it out for a couple months.
That's exactly that's the point that I'm trying to make with people is that learn where you live. Know something about when the first frost of the year comes, when that average date is, when the earliest, when the latest, know when the last frost is and what the variation is around those types of things. And then think about how quickly it warms up. You know, when does the hot weather start to come? You have to learn about the cool weather vegetables, the warm weather vegetables, whether I'm transplanting, whether I'm seeding, whether I'm using plastics, whether I'm not, whether I'm doing it this way or whether I'm doing it that way. And you can see why people are so confused, because there is a lot to learn. And you know, certainly an example of that would be I was reading an article by quite a well-known greenhouse tomato grower, and he said there's 100 things you need to know about growing tomatoes in a greenhouse. And the person that was kind of interviewing him says, well, how will I ever learn those? And he said, well, you need to learn one every year. And so it's going to take you 100 years to know how to grow greenhouse tomatoes. That's kind of what gardening is all about, because there are, you know, we commonly grow about, you could in theory grow about 60 different vegetables, and each one of them is slightly different than the other ones. We kind of classify them into leafy greens, you know, your fruiting types. Melons versus squash versus this. So, you know, you can kind of start to lump them together. So then it starts to get a little bit easier, but there's still a lot that you need to know. And so the resources that we have, the conversations that we have here on the Zesty Garden, that only gets you started on the vegetables. Well, then you need to have Grant come in to help, you know, sort out those soil problems. You need to have Diane come in and sort out those disease problems. You need to have someone else come in and sort out the disease, the pest problems. You know, there's just a plethora of stuff that you need to learn. And so if you never start, you never learn. So my conversations with you are to try and get people to start. And don't start with too much. Sometimes people start too big and they get frustrated. So start small, work your way up. And like you said, I didn't have asparagus. I used to have a few plants. Now I got three huge rows and I'm kind of doing this and I'm doing that. And, you know, that's the way you learn. And so the 100 questions or the 100 things that you need to know, you can learn probably more than one a year. But, you know, there are certain principles that we need to aspire toward. And if you understand those basic things, then everything else starts to fall into place.
When I was 11, I decided that I was going to expand and start growing all the vegetables that were coming from Porter Walton and that seed rack in my grandpa's store. Oh, boy, it was it was full of weeds just because I didn't know what I was doing and I wasn't able to concentrate on just a couple. I thought I had to plant everything.
That's right. And so, you know, that's what we're trying to get our listeners to think about. And, you know, your garden is as big as you want it to be. It can be as small as the lady that called me last year and had one tomato plant on her patio. And to her, that was the most important plant that she had growing, or it can be that person that has a quarter acre or a half acre under cultivation in their backyard that is also trying to take some of that product down to the local farmer's market. And their needs are no different than the person that has that one tomato plant, because they're dealing with all of the same issues. How do I feed it? How do I water it? How do I make sure the pests don't get it? How do I know when it's ripe? When should I start planting? You know, all of those kinds of things are what we're going to talk about over the course of this summer. And so a month from now, I'll be back and we'll be talking about the next phases of things. You know, we'll probably say something about asparagus harvest, and we'll talk about how growth is going, and we'll talk about getting those melons in the ground, and we'll talk about, you know, all of that stuff that's important to making your garden a success. So
what would you plant in the next 70 or so seconds? What would you plant right now?
I would continue to plant things like spinach and lettuce and parsleys, turnips, chards. Those are things that you can easily plant right now. If you want to seed things like broccoli and cabbage and that kind of stuff, you could actually direct seed those and, you know, forego the transplanting, though it's not maybe always efficient for us to do it that way.
So it'll be more of a fall harvest?
No, they would mature a little bit later than our transplanted stuff, but they get a good establishment at this time. They build up a better root system. Oftentimes they'll take the heat a little bit better. So that might be a way to do some things. Wait a couple weeks up here in Logan for planting broccoli and cabbage and that kind of stuff, because it's still a little early. But in some of our warmer regions, maybe Moab and those areas, yeah, we should start thinking about transplanting broccoli and cabbage and that kind of stuff. Certainly in St. George, those things should have been done already. And then get transplants started. If you're going to start some transplants, you still have time in the cooler areas to get your tomatoes and peppers started if you don't want to buy them. Wait a few weeks for the melons to transplant, start those. But if you're in the warmer regions, they should be started because we're planting melons, as I said, in St. George. So, I mean, you got to know where you live. And I don't know where you live. I just know where I live.
Dan, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Been listening to The Zesty Garden. Dan Drost is USU's Extension Vegetable Specialist, and we'll be back next month.